the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing, subscribe to our podcast, leave us a lovely 5-star review, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application you could take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And apparently, JustTalk was ransomwared by the Maytag repairman.
You should remember this. This will make sense later.
All right. So the first article is AIG Threat Group launches with unique business model. This comes to us from Dark Reading.
Which is kind of weird because their business model is not that unique. It's only unique in the context of crime. Criminals. Criming.
Criming?
That's I heard it on a podcast a couple months ago and I've decided I love it. It's like crime or no criming, crime or no criming. If you say it 3 times, they have to stop. All right, I'll stop.
But the threat actor or the attacker in this scenario is Atlas Intelligence Group or the Atlantis Cyber Army. So I like the second one better.
Really? Hmm. I'd be really disappointed if they didn't have gills. And
what? Aquaman doesn't have gills. But this AIG group is relying on cyber mercenaries, as they call it, to carry out the missions. So this is really built on a premise that we talked about on this show many months ago, where a threat actor would provide a service where the customer would be able to choose which portion of the attack sequence they wanted provided by which group. And in this case, the person providing the service chooses those elements, but they don't actually do any part of it. They sublet or subcontract every part of the hack, the whole thing. They just coordinate it.
So why are they calling them cyber mercenaries and not calling them mechanical Turks or contractors or staff aug or something like that?
Does it sound sexy?
I want to be called a cyber mercenary. Dang it.
But really, this is more like a general contractor when you build a house or something.
Got to go get a plumber, got to go get a carpenter, got to go get a drywall guy, a painting guy.
Yep, electrician, all that. The same kind of principle here. So this research company called CyberInt spotted the group, I guess, identified the group in May. And the threat actor offers a variety of services. So access to databases, exclusive data leaks, trivia denial service, and initial access via RDP or web shells. But as I said, they perform no part of any of this. Apparently, when a client goes to AIG and says, hey, I want to do this thing, or I want you to do this thing, AIG then turns around and puts out an ad for whatever aspects of the attack that they need. You know, so if someone says, hey, I want to do a denial of service, then they'll go and they'll try to find someone who owns a botnet or something, or they'll advertise for, hey, I'm looking for a hacking services to do this thing.
That's interesting. Do they have like a guarantee that they can find it, or is it best effort, or?
You know, I was thinking the same thing, because that kind of leaves them open to, you know, what if there's a problem where they can't get someone to provide that service, then what they would have to do is go back to their client and say, hey, I can't do this thing. And if that happens often enough, then they're going to lose the reputation that's going to allow them to do any work at all. So they must be pretty secure in that. So I was thinking, rather than do this, you know, advertising for each client, that they would have folks basically on retainer or something like that instead, or have some kind of relationship where they would automatically call these folks up or whatever and say, almost like I was thinking that it could be along the lines of like a bug bounty program. We have like a set of hackers that have been vetted or approved to do the work, and you just contract them or call them up and say, hey, I've got this opportunity. Do you want to take advantage of it or not? But I suppose if they did that, then they wouldn't be able to reduce the cost by having people bid for that work. Mm-hmm. You know, like a general contractor or an electrician, the general contractor may know a guy, or he may put out an ad and say, hey, I need an electrician. And electricians say, I can do that job for $10,000 or $9,000 or whatever, and they'll get the lowest bidder in that case.
Yeah, I wonder how much bidding there's going to be. In terms of contractors, there's a, like, and you're talking about housing, there's a certain rate that people don't bid below because they know it won't make them enough money. But when you're thinking about things like Mechanical Turk or Fiverr, where it's people sitting at home and just doing things while they're sitting on their butt on their computer, they tend to bid a lot lower without any real regard to their skill or what got them there. And they tend to, yeah, they sometimes bid very low for things that maybe they should be charging more for.
Well, I guess they'll learn that over time. And I suppose AIG also has to learn over time, because someone may bid really low and they'll let the contract out for, you know, remote access services or whatever, or initial access services. And then that guy falls through or gives them, you know, bad access or the wrong access or something like that. And AIG is the one that looks like they've messed up because they subcontracted out and the client didn't get what they asked for. But in the marketplace works this out. It just takes some time.
Yeah.
And I think if this bot model gets more widely adopted, then you're more likely to get what we've talked about before in the Yelp for attackers or Yelp for ransomware. And some contractors simply won't be able to get work because they're not good enough. And the ones who are really good will be overworked.
I contracted for him to take down this website for 24 hours. They only took it down for 2 hours. 1 star.
Yep, exactly. So AIG is the first one in the group here. And then as more pile on, then maybe someone will stand up that well for criminal enterprises then.
Mm-hmm.
Just for AIG alone, it's not enough. But once more start adding on to this.
So I wonder if it would be useful to have a third-party review site then to track these people across the different sites. Because when this place gets shut down and they all move to a different site, like they're going to need to have some continuity of their reviews. I smell a business plan. Let's go get some funding.
Well, I'm thinking what I'm thinking of is the review site is wholly separate.
Yeah, because it's not doing anything illegal.
It's not doing anything illegal.
Right.
Exactly.
Yep.
It's simply hosting the rates. So it's not tied into the contracting part of it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah. Now, how do you make money off that?
Advertising for these sites.
Oh, man. Which is more evil?
Or getting paid by the government to help them keep track of the bad guys. Like, every time we advertise with these sites, we get shut down by the government. What? How does this keep happening?
Pure coincidence, I assure you.
Pure coincidence. I guess it depends on which one comes after us first and threatens us first.
All right, well, which one knows where you live? And
which, as you're fond of saying, which one has the guns?
Yeah.
They both do in this case. So maybe that's not such a great idea.
I don't know. I think we could figure it out. All right, moving on. So apparently this AIG group is run by one person, and they have like three lieutenants who help them with different aspects of it. And each lieutenant has a set domain that they're responsible for. So one does the advertising, one does the communications, and one runs the Telegram channels.
Do you know what the Telegram channels are? Because I kind of want to get on there.
They weren't listed in any of the articles that I read, so I'm not sure which channels those are.
Said day.
But the speculation from the Cyber Int is that the main guy, at least, if not him and his lieutenants, were all former red teamers or hackers that decided, hey, that this is a better business model, let's try that out, even though they won't be leveraging any of their skills in the work. Now, you mentioned the Telegraph channels. So they have three channels, each dedicated to a different thing, and every one of these channels has thousands of subscribers already. And that seems like that must have really taken off then, if this group really did just stand up in May and they've already got thousands of subscribers, just a couple of ones left. But one channel is for marketing their databases that they've gotten access to. And apparently when they grant exclusive access to databases, so if you pay for database access, you are going to be the only one that gets that access. They are not selling that access to anybody else either.
Which is weird, because I think one of them said that some of the databases were as low as 15 euros. That seems very low for exclusive access.
Well, it's exclusive access, I'm guessing, to crap data. You know, so you're going to pay based on the quality of the data that's in the database is my expectation. So the second channel is for advertising for hacking services, you know, where they're looking for, hey, I need a malware developer, or I need a social engineer, or I need a spammer or something like that. So they have one channel just dedicated towards basically soliciting for hackers to apply for work that they have available. And then the last channel is their communication channel, which is general group announcements, a list of targets, and other general information for the group. Now, in addition, on top of all that, they have an e-commerce store where people can purchase the services using cryptocurrency.
Weirdly enough, setting up this kind of competition, I feel like it's going to drive down the prices of malicious action. We talked about it a little bit before, but they mentioned some of the databases were selling for as little as 15 euros, and some credit cards now are selling for only a few dollars each on the dark web in caps. But this makes me wonder, we're going to get like different vendors. We're going to have like the McDonald's of cybercrime, where you go in there when you want to, you know, for $10, go hack your little buddy, you know, in high school or whatever. And then we're going to have like the Nordstrom's of cybercrime, where you go and get your concierge to go pin something on your wife so that when you can get divorced, you can blame it all on her and go live with your mistress or whatever.
I think you're exactly right on how that's going to work out. Because when you're talking about the market, the company that can drive down prices and still maintain an expected level of quality are the ones that are going to be successful. So, you know, Henry Ford brought the car down through his practices to $400, which lowered the price for what everybody else was paying for cars and got them more broadly adopted throughout the whole country because of those low prices. But he didn't stay the only guy that could offer a $400 car.
Right.
You know, Chevrolet and Chrysler and these other companies come along competing with that have continued to keep prices lower. This whole point of competition. But when you're standing up a new business, you have to, one of the things that you come up with is, how are you going to distinguish yourself from someone else? So maybe AIG is going to be the general purpose one that just has the low rent people. And, you know, maybe CityHack will come in and they will have only the best initial access brokers, or the best ransomware people, or the best spammers or whatever. And they will. And because they're the best, they will be able to charge that higher price for their service. So if you go to CityHack, you're going to know that you're going to pay more, but you're going to be paying for a higher quality. And AIG is also not regionally dependent or sector dependent. They're simply basing who they're going to attack on the expected payout. So they seem to be, at least based on what Cyberint has observed up to this point, is that they are not in any way tied to, you know, they'd say the Chinese or the Russians or anything like that. They're like, you know, can these people pay? And that's who will attack.
Huh. I mean, that's how you make money.
So of course, why does this matter? Is, as we mentioned before, this is this whole effort is going to lead to the increased quality of attacks while reducing the costs, which means that you're going to end up with more attackers and better skilled ones over time.
I don't know that it's going to increase the quality of attacks. I think it's going to increase the quantity for sure. I think it will eventually increase the quality, but I think there's going to be an initial kind of bump as a bunch of people try to use this as like getting into the, because so right now there's probably a whole ecosystem of amateur attackers that think they're good enough, but haven't been able to make their way into the criminals' main gangs yet because they're really not good enough. And by farming out work like this, there's going to be a bunch of amateurs that are like, yeah, I'll take the gig. And they're going to stumble their way through it. And then they're going to get blacklisted and be like, no, we're not farming anything out to you ever again.
I guess this is all still actually going to depend on that Yelp for crimeware, because you're going to have a way to track the quality of who you're hiring over time. Because what you'll end up with is you'll end up with the spread, you know, low quality attackers for low cost, high quality attackers for high cost. And unless it's like, I think I heard this about Uber, like if you end up with less than a 4-star rating, you know, you will never get any riders or something like that.
But
you
the
could
problem
end up
is
in a scenario like that for in this scenario as well, is where if you get too low a star rating, simply no one will hire you ever for anything.
But do they have that star rating at AIG?
No. I'm saying that this Yelp for Yelp.
Yeah. You need that. Because
Yelp
otherwise,
for crimeware is necessary, I think, for this.
Because otherwise your only signal is the money. Because otherwise there's no incentive for the wannabe criminal to not charge like $10,000 in Bitcoin, do a shitty job, and then change their name and do the next job for $10,000 in Bitcoin and do a shitty job and change their name.
Right.
Like, without that reputation, you've got the early days of eBay.
Yeah. At this point, you have to rely on AIG doing that vetting and that management.
Which is way more work than three people or four people or whatever it is.
Right. So I think you're going to find other people are going to be watching this, and they're going to, it's kind of be like the way that ransomware took off, I think, where people are going to be watching AIG. And if AIG is successful, then other people are going to adopt this model. And then you'll get multiple attack brokers offering the same service. And then someone's going to come up with, you know, the Yelp for crimeware. And then, you know, it'll just go from there. So I think, you know, while I find this really interesting because I'm really into market forces and everything, I don't think this bodes well for us on the defense side. I think this is bad, and this is going to make things worse for us, I think, because the last thing you want is a successful crime market. And of course, what we could do about it is not much. You're going to have to do the general hygiene and maintenance that you typically do. But I think one thing that, depending on who you are or what you do, you may or may not find this concerning, but you can throw attribution out the window, because any attack is actually going to be made up of numerous different threat actors from all over the globe, probably. And you're not going to be able to say this attack was done by this threat actor. You can say AIG brokered it, but, you know, if they're just a broker, then it doesn't really tell you anything about the purpose for the attack or anything like that. You've got the actual attribution is a step divorced from the action. So if you wanted to say, just put it in simplistic terms, that Russia was attacking the United States. If Russia went through an attack broker like AIG, your only way that you're going to do that attribution is be able to track the money trail from Russia to AIG. And that's it. Because once AIG starts farming out the work to different threat actors, each one of these people could be anywhere on the globe, you know, doing the initial access and then deploying the malware or whatever. And they're completely divorced from the reason for the attack in the first place. They're doing it as part of a job. They're a cog in a wheel getting in and getting the access. So if you want to do attribution at that point, you can forget about you doing forensics or anything like that in order to tie that attribution back to the purposeful threat actor that targeted you.
Yep. And you can almost guarantee that every intelligence agency across the globe is rubbing their hands about this. They're like, wait a second, we don't have to maintain a tailored access group anymore. Like, if these guys get good, we can just use them.
Oh, that would be crazy. If like the CIA saw this or the NSA saw this and say, you know, what's missing here is a Yelp for crimeware. And they're actually the ones that stood up the Yelp for crimeware server so that they could get this up and running and track all these guys and get the ratings and everything so that they could pick their cyber mercenaries.
Oh my God. Yeah. And they could, because they could then use that to drop malware or backdoor on every one of their systems and then track them.
Yep. And then they just wipe their hands up and say, hey, wasn't me.
Yeah. That's amazing. And then, because then they would get a copy of everything that all these people downloaded. Oh man. Anyways.
All right. So second good news one. There.
Oh, it's good news. Good news. Yeah. The government needs to get in there and.
No. Like I said, yeah. If this takes off, this is going to be a bad day for everybody, I think.
A bad day for everybody. Okay. All right. Item number two for months. Just Talk messages were accessible to everyone on the internet. Yay. So what we have here is from Malwarebytes blog. A popular mobile video calling and messaging app called Just Talk, which I had never heard of before this, but had 20 million global users. They apparently had left a massive database of supposedly private messages and information exposed to the public for months. It was first exposed in early January, at least, as best as we can tell. It appears that this was a bug, a logging database that was used for app bugs and errors. As an open database, the messages were stored unencrypted, and the database itself was not behind a password. If you go on the Just Talk website, the Just Talk website says, Rest assured, your calls and messages are secured. Only you and the person you communicate with can see, read, or listen to them. Even the Just Talk team won't access your data.
And of course, won't access and can access are two different things.
What?
Yeah, so, I was actually looking to find the note in here. So this was actually discovered by an independent researcher named Anurang Sen, who posted it on Twitter. But TechCrunch did a follow-up on it, which we'll talk more about in a minute. Just want to make sure we get the attribution down there before we get too far into this.
That's fair. So there are hundreds of gigabytes of data hosted on a Huawei server in China. Huawei, that's 2 weeks in a row we're talking about them or something like that. You can access the data using a web browser if you have the right IP address. That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, so apparently what they actually left open was a web front end to the database if you could get there with a web browser and IP address. It wasn't like the database port was open to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if that wasn't the front end for the company to access the database is what was left open.
Yeah, that makes sense. They were able to find in there chat logs, video logs, location data, data of child users from their Just Talk Kids app. Isn't that lovely? Records from their Just Talk second phone number, which allows the users to create a ephemeral phone number. So you can give that out instead of giving out your cell phone number.
I have not heard a service like that before. It's kind of like the throwaway emails. It's a pretty good idea.
It is, but only if you don't reveal the records of the second phone number.
You mean if this stuff is not posted on the internet for anybody to find, you mean?
Yeah, that seems important. So they were collecting and storing more than 10 million individual logs every day, including millions of messages sent over the app, which included the phone numbers, the recipient of the sender and recipient, the message itself, and all placed calls. Which makes me wonder, why does the government keep asking about a backdoor when the companies just put this stuff on the internet anyways?
Maybe it got there because the government told the employee to put it there.
That's fair. That's fair.
That's like the Napoleon quote about, you know, don't ascribe to maliciousness that which can be explained by incompetence.
Yeah.
But, you know, how many other vendors are doing this on purpose, though? You know, the telcos, they've already got portals and stuff set up for law enforcement to manage their wiretaps. I assume that these portals are just for managing the wiretaps, though, and that the telcos are going through proper due diligence to ensure that the law enforcement have proper warrants for that.
Sure.
But the fact that telcos are charging between $1,000 and $3,000 per wiretap per month, they're probably not too incentivized to be overly rigorous with their evaluation of those warrants.
Yeah, I can't imagine why.
As we mentioned a minute ago, TechCrunch also did a follow-up on this. So, and they found evidence that the database had been accessed before and maybe even copies of the data had been taken out of there. They found a undated ransom note left by some extortionist in the database, which apparently was left for the company to find, which apparently they didn't. And the blockchain associated with in the ransom note hasn't gotten any funds sent to it. So this guy must be a complete noob. Because they didn't know where to put the note to ensure that the company found it.
Can you just imagine being the ransom guy? Like they find this, they make a copy of the data, they leave the note, they sit back in their computer and like they finish sending all this and they just sit back and they're waiting for the negotiation to begin. They're waiting for the money to arrive. They're imagining what they're going to do and what they're going to spend it on and just nothing, just radio silence. The company doesn't even notice that you were there. We'll talk about next week when we talk about the other 200 days that it takes to notice a breach. So I guess this shouldn't really be a surprise, right?
Well, apparently he wasn't a ransomware guy, though, because he didn't do any encryption. But he just stole it and said, I have a copy of it instead. And I'm not sure, in a scenario like that, if the company is actually going to say, yeah, I'll pay you for that data anyway. But TechCrunch tried to get a hold of the company. They tried to get a hold of the founder, Leo Lev, and several other executives, but no emails returned. The company didn't seem to do anything about the database. So TechCrunch published their article about 2 weeks ago or so. And after that happened, then the database was taken offline.
What? Shocking.
Yeah. Well, apparently they were watching the news or something. They were watching something in order to find out that it happened. But in the same article, just as a follow-up to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago, is that the big Chinese residence that was stolen from the, or they the criminal records of 1 billion Chinese people who had their records stolen from the Shanghai Police Department. Apparently, that was actually stolen from the Alibaba's cloud, which wasn't clear in any of those articles. But for some reason, I can't remember exactly why, but that was mentioned in this one. But the whole reason that this is even important is if someone else is managing your encryption keys, then you can't be certain that those transactions are inaccessible by a third party. You know, they said that your data is encrypted end-to-end or whatever, but apparently you shouldn't have believed them. So, and third-party management of keys, this happens virtually any place you see, hey, your data is end-to-end encrypted. iMessage, Zoom, any of those services, they're actually managing your encryption keys for you in the background so that you don't have to do it yourself. And if someone's doing that, then you can never have absolute certainty that your information is actually end-to-end encrypted and nobody else can see it. Now, everybody likes to say, well, security people like to say anyway, that you shouldn't trust anybody.
But yeah, if you're going to do that, then you can't use your phone, you can't use your TV, you can't use, like, life becomes impossible if you can't trust anybody.
Right. In security, there, trust is embedded in the system. You know, it's just you have to figure out who you're going to trust and when. Not necessarily that you shouldn't trust anybody. So, you need to do your own level of due diligence up to the point where you're comfortable with that what you're being told is accurate or truthful. And I'll give you a simple example. And this is not an endorsement for either of these two products, but just as an example for this. So ExpressVPN, it's a paid VPN service. They've been audited by a third party. They detail information about the audit, how their service worked, what the audit covered and all this stuff. And they post these messages on their website over several pages. Now there's another VPN provider called ProtonVPN. It's a free VPN, which is an open source and has also been audited by a third party. And they published the actual audit reports on their website. So if you're going to choose a VPN, which of those do you think is more trustworthy than the other? I'm not saying that one is, but these are the kind of decision, the kind of research and the kind of information you have to collect when you're trying to make a decision about your security, about, you know, what do you think is the proper level of security for you and your organization?
Yeah. Other options in terms of if you just wanted to use a messaging app, you could always move to Signal or Telegram. Those seem to be pretty secure. Or should you? I don't know. Maybe it turns out that they're keeping secret copies of everything too. That's not, none of these are transparent to you, and it's very difficult for you to tell.
And wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility. So last year, it was reported that the FBI and the Australian Federal Police had designed a quote unquote secure encrypted communications platform called Anom and marketed it to criminal gangs because it suited their needs for encryption or secure communications, or so they thought. But they ended up using this app to monitor criminals for 3 years and got all the copies of any messages that were exchanged using that app. And the way that they did that is, and this is the quote, the Australian Federal Police supervisor or commissioner, that they built a master key into the existing encryption system, which surreptitiously attached each message and enabled law enforcement to decrypt and store the message as it's transmitted. So in other words, if I were sending a message to Matt, it would encrypt that message with Matt's public key and send it to Matt. And it also would encrypt that message with the law enforcement's public key and send them a copy of that message. And then they would decrypt it. So sure, it was end-to-end encrypted and law enforcement couldn't tap in on that, but they simply got a copy of the encrypted message because they were also a party of that transmission. So it's kind of as if I were sending not only a message to Matt, but also to the BCC. Cops at the same time. Yep. But of course, that part of the transaction or that part of the message was for all messages, and the sender and the receiver never realized that transmission was taking place.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.